happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. I'm going to be starting on the telephone, hopefully in a few minutes. I can switch over to a microphone. We're trying to make that connection. I'm on the road today. We're going to talk about if you have poor night vision, I've got good information, and it's going to help your vision. Also today, we're going to explore how to prevent bone loss. This is a study from the University of Auckland in New Zealand, and we have so many people who have osteoporosis, and we shouldn't have that at all. In fact, the five leading dairy-consuming countries in the world have the most osteoporosis. Someone should have been paying attention to this, but maybe they were. But paying more attention was the dairy industry. Scientists discover vitamin C regulates stem cell function. That helps curb leukemia and cancers from developing. This is from the University of Texas Southwestern. And what does this mean? In lay language, I'll explain how you can literally rejuvenate your cells with vitamin C. And astaxanthin can help protect skin health from within. So new research there. And yoga meditation improve mind-body health and stress reliance. So we'll share information on that. Also, I promised yesterday that I would offer a commentary on how biased we are, maybe unintentionally. Maybe we have just been trusting our sources of historical data to the point where we neglect to do our own homework. So today, I'm going to show you three examples, if time permits, about how biased our view of history is. I'm going to do a commentary on the founding of America's West and what really went into it and what role different groups played and how much of this is simply not existent in our current historical narrative. Also, I will take a look at what's really behind, even if people are not aware of it, but what's behind wanting to take a knee at the anthem or tearing down a statue. There's a far deeper and more profound understanding of history that has been completely sanitized. I'll share that with you. And if time permits today, and there'll be a special commentary from, again, if time permits, from Chris Hedges on this very issue about the abuses of history. Also, I have not watched Ken Burns' new 10-part, 13 or 14-hour series on the Vietnam War. But I'm going to ask Ken a question, and I'm then going to, if time permits, going to open it for calls. And I don't believe, again, I haven't seen it, but I don't believe that this has been brought into the films. But maybe some of you who've watched it up to this point will have a different perspective. So I'll be open to your interpretation of what you've seen if you've watched the Ken Burns PBS Vietnam series. So we have a lot to share today. So let's begin. And we're going to be beginning with something that doesn't have much sex appeal. Most people don't talk about it. You see rarely anything written about it, but it's age-related macular degeneration. And that impacts night driving, impacts the ability to read at night. A lot of people begin to lose their low-light vision before they are aware of how bad it is. And night driving becomes increasingly difficult and dangerous as you get older if your eyes are not really healthy, primarily related to the changes in our vision and eye structure. And many older people restrict their driving by avoiding high-risk situations such as night driving. But here are some things that are not taken into effect. Even normal retinal aging limits our vision, especially in the dark. And those with early age-related macular degeneration are over 400% more likely to report difficulty with night driving and 500% more likely to have trouble with near vision, and nearly 300% as likely to have difficulty with glare and flaring, where if you look up at a street light, it'll flare, and coming traffic, the night light will flare. That's all a sign of the same problem. And by the way, at least 43% of people 5 years out from cataract surgery experience glare-related difficulties with driving. So what can we do about it? Number one, the solution lies with macular carotenoids. These are natural plant pigments that we must consume in order to shield our vulnerable retinal cells from degeneration as we age. Now, those pigments, such as lutein, L-U-T-E-I-N, zeaxanthin, Z-E-A-X-A-N-T-H-I-N, and meso, M-E-S-O, zeaxanthin, have been really abundantly studied. The peer-reviewed literature shows that they protect your retina. And even new studies show that the supplementation with these pigments provide targeted benefits important to night driving, night reading, diminishing of flaring, etc. And so that's what I want people to realize, that you don't have to automatically assume that it's not reversible. Most people would be surprised to know that your eyes naturally contain pigments that are found in plants, such as spinach and kale and corn, even collard greens. And these macular carotenoids consist of lutein, xanthine, and mesoxanthin pigments. And macular carotenoids absorb blue light, which is one of the most damaging kinds of visual light. Now, you've heard me mention many times, it's the blue light that's coming through your cell phone. It's the blue light that's coming through your computer screen. It's the blue light that's coming through your television. So the more time we have on eye screen contact, the more damaging we're doing. Then you add in how close are you. Rule one, never sit within 3 feet, 36 inches, of your computer, meaning your hard drive is generally on the floor, and your computer screen. Always keep it at a distance. Always use your cell phone with the hollow tubes, which can make a difference and protect you. That's all important. And then, not only does the blue light have a problem, it's really bad for you, these carotenoids are also capable of preventing some of the oxidative stress experienced by the delicate light receptors in the retina. And the retina is the layer of nerve cells that sends visual information from the eye to the brain. So macular carotenoids occur naturally in retinal pigmented epithelium that lies just underneath the light-sensitive cells of the retina. And there they act much the way that blue light filters in front of computer screens do to reduce the amount of harmful blue light that our retinas must experience. So we need these retinoids. We need the macular carotenoids. And we get these by having a good quality vegan diet. 10 milligrams of lutein would be terrific. And maybe 5 milligrams of xanthan, and the same for mesoxanthan. So those are some suggestions that can really make a difference and help us when it comes to vision. Don't take your vision for granted. From the University of Auckland, this was an interesting article. And it was interesting because it was completely different than what anything I've seen in the United States academia would write. I don't believe it's because there's a general conspiracy to prevent this information. I do believe that there are so many special interests that these special interests would make sure that you do not get this information. Professors in all areas of science and environmental sciences have been hired by GMO companies to write positive articles, to downplay any negative responses. They've done it with sugar, they've done it with meat, and they are major, major voices. Let me give you an example of how it works. Let's just say that you wanted to do a congressional hearing on how bad is the American diet. So you on the head of the committee, and you're the most powerful person, the chairperson of the committee, they decide the topic, they decide who the experts will be on the panel, and they're the ones who count. Now, most of these panels are bipartisan, meaning you have some Democrats and Republicans. What people are not aware of, the same corporate sponsors fund both the Democrats and Republicans, but super fund, hyper fund, the chairperson. Hence, you have a group of maybe 10, 12, 14 scientists come forward from different institutions. The institutions are household names, and they're considered respectable. So their background, their qualifications are never suspect. They're never questioned. And they say, well, there's been a lot of panic by food cultists and food alarmists and food faddists who want us to be on these scientifically unsupported vegan diets. But the scientific literature clearly supports that meat is a complete protein, the others are not, and that throughout time immemorial, going clear back to even the paleo diet, relied upon animal proteins. The fact that today we can, through industrialized farming and good science, we can put more lean protein on a pig, more on a cow, more on a chicken. And we have good safety standards through the USDA and the meat inspection and the dairy inspection. So we say, as long as you're not having a diet exclusively of a single item and have moderation all things, then you should be fine. Well, you get the dominant number of scientists on that panel saying that, and suddenly that becomes official policy. Then the head of the committee sends off memorandums to the USDA, the FDA, and there you have people like Michael Taylor, former lawyer for Monsanto, who was selected by Bush but reselected by Obama to head the food safety. So how likely is it that the former lawyer for Monsanto is going to, in any way, challenge the safety of GMO foods and glyphosate? All the agencies have corporate supportive people who are running them. So the fix is in at every level. So we, the public, get an article saying meat is cleared against all these fads. And that's how we get our information. However, one of the reasons that it's rare that people like myself, who are actually experts in the area and have done our homework and are scholars and have spent tens of thousands of hours reviewing tens of thousands of studies, we're never invited. Because if we did, then we would show that they don't have a single article on their side. In fact, every article on meat and dairy and pork, even fish, shows that it contributes to disease. And the only thing that prevents disease is a plant-based diet. So if you have 1,000 studies showing a plant-based diet from good journals, Journal of the American Medical Association, The Lancet, the British Medical Journal, etc., and they're all positive for plants, and they're all negative for animal proteins, then how likely is it that the media is going to publish that article? I mentioned on a recent show that I was asked if I could be interviewed by a reporter. I said, fine. And I said, what's your interest? Well, we want to see if people can actually be healed by any of the information you're giving. And I said, well, who are you asking? Well, we're doing our homework. And that's when I was at the Roosevelt Hotel in the Grand Ballroom, and it was the largest turnout for a lecture, I was told, in the history of the hotel. They had over 1,000 people that couldn't take seats. It was that crowded. So I asked the people in the room, I said, we have a reporter here. How many people have had disease reversed? That where they were under the care of a physician, stayed under the care of a physician, but based on your lifestyle changes, you were able to reverse the course of disease. Every hand went up. All right, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, all the hands went up. And so I said, well, here's your experts, because if you just took my word for it, that can be biased. I could be saying something self-serving. But here are the people who are the real experts. Talk with them. She didn't interview a single person. Not a person. But she did interview Dr. Stephen Barrett, who ran the Quack Watch, and he became the expert. Now, she only did her homework to see, what's this man an expert in? Was he the same person that was found in a California court to have lost all of his lawsuits recently, but also to the judges said he was had no proficiency and no expertise in the very areas, and he said he backtracked and said he was only giving his opinion. Well, if you have no degrees, no background, no registration, no board certification in anything related to health, you're a psychiatrist and you stopped practicing years and years ago. And so why should a reporter accept a person who has no background in a field, accept that person's opinion over all the people in a room, including physicians and nurses and professors? I said, anyone here who's in a health profession or who has a PhD or higher education, who therefore would be more capable of critical analysis, and all, at least 300 hands went up. So when I suggest that having the truth on your side does not mean that that truth in any way, shape, or form permeates the mainstream media, that's what I'm referring to. In any case, so we go back to the University of Auckland, and they said, quote, dairy products, specifically milk, is one of the beverages still aggressively pushed as a health-promoting food, especially relating to strong bones. However, bone mineral density, or BMD, and rates of bone loss showed no association with dietary calcium intake in men. And this was published in the British Journal of Nutrition. Well, the dairy industry has been hard at work for, what, 50, 60 years, convincing people that pasteurized dairy products, such as milk and cheese, increases bioavailable calcium. It does not. Many, many studies have exposed this claim as being fraudulent. The pasteurization process only creates calcium carbonate, which has absolutely no way of entering the cells without a chelating agent. So what the body does is pull the calcium from the bones and other tissues in order to buffer the calcium carbonate in the blood. And this process actually causes osteoporosis. Now, pasteurization of dairy products contains almost no magnesium needed at the proper ratio to absorb the calcium. And most people agree that a minimum amount of calcium to magnesium ratio is 2-to-1. I believe it should be 1-to-1 because it's actually magnesium that has the greatest capacity for bone density. And yet milk, including cheese and yogurt, has a calcium magnesium ratio of 10-to-1. That's a big problem. If you put 1,200 milligrams of dairy calcium in your mouth, but you will be lucky to absorb maybe a third of that into your system. And over 99% of the body's calcium is in the skeleton, where it provides, of course, mechanical rigidity. And pasteurized dairy forms a calcium intake lower than normal, and the skeleton is used as a reserve to meet needs. So you use dairy over a period of time, you can end up with osteoporosis. No matter how much money they spend into hiring actors and famous people to wear that stupid I've got milk mustache, it's all a lie. Everything out there on this topic is a lie. I just want you to be aware of that. Because if you are aware of that, don't eat dairy in any form. One of the very first things I take people off of is I take them off all dairy products. Nothing from a cow goes in their system. And then, lo and behold, osteoporosis over a period of 6 months is reversed. And that's important to understand. So how do you get your calcium? Well, it's simple. Not difficult at all. You can get it from sardines, your green vegetables like kale and broccoli and spinach, collard greens, dried herbs, dried fruits like figs and currants and dates, sesame seeds, chia seeds, flax seeds, all rich in calcium, but in a form that is good. And if you eat garlic and onions, also good. And try not to eat whole grains and calcium-rich foods at the same time. Whole grains contain a substance that binds with calcium and prevents full absorption. And some foods that contain compounds such as oxalic acid and phytic acids would be sweet potatoes and beans and rhubarb and celery and beets that can decrease the amount of calcium. So what I would suggest you do is just have that separately. Also, avoid the cause of mineral excretion. Just say no to phosphate-containing foods. The number one phosphate-containing ingredients in the United States are found in soft drinks. Why don't you want a soft drink? It's simple. Phosphorus causes the body to excrete calcium. You want to limit or avoid these high-protein animal foods. They are also anti-calcium. A diet high in protein causes calcium to be excreted from your body. Also, caffeine does the same thing. So, alcohol also prevents your bones from absorbing the maximum nutrients for your body. Get a lot of sunlight because vitamin D helps the body absorb calcium, and exercise helps the body absorb more calcium. So those are just some things that can make a difference. And finally, from the University of Texas, Southwestern, there is new research about stem cells. Now, I'll be doing a full program on stem cells very, very soon, but I just want you to know that not a whole lot is known by the general public about stem cell metabolism. But a new study from Children's Medical Center Research Institute at the University of Texas Southwestern has found that stem cells take up unusually high levels of vitamin C, which then regulates their function and suppresses the development of leukemia. This is from the study. Quote, "We have known for a while that people with low levels of vitamin C or ascorbate are at an increased cancer risk, but we haven't fully understood why. Our research provides part of the explanation, at least for the blood-forming system." That was the direct of the study. Now, just in lay language, the metabolism of stem cells has historically been difficult to study because a large number of cells are required for metabolic analysis. And while stem cells in each tissue of the body are rare, this technique developed during the study, which was published in Nature, the most respected scientific magazine in the world, have allowed researchers to routinely measure metabolite levels in rare cell populations such as stem cells. And the techniques led researchers to discover that every type of blood-forming cell in the bone marrow had distinct metabolic signatures, taking up and using nutrients in their own individual way. And one of the main metabolic features of stem cells is they really, really take up a lot of ascorbate, which is vitamin C. So that's what they found. So take your vitamin C, ideally 6 times a day, and you could be helping your stem cells, and that helps you keep younger, longer, and that helps slow down the aging process and helps prevent disease. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come back. Please stay with us.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I met a person who's in a market, and the person came over and says, "I listen each day at night to your program. I download it, and when I can't download it, I go up to the internet, and I call that phone number, and I listen live." I said, "Good." And he said, "I've got a question for you." He said, "I don't know who to believe. Maybe you can address it on one of your upcoming programs." He said, "I keep hearing from people on the right and some on the left how remarkable America is, how unique we have been. And therefore, we shouldn't be critical of our history, because our history has given us the platform for which we can have the quality of life we have today. And I said, and what caveat have you used to measure that against? He said, well, that's the problem. I don't know any. And I said, well, okay, I'll address that on an upcoming program. Well, this is the program. First, I'm only going to focus upon the Old West. And why? Because we like to think the Old West was based upon cowboys and hunters and what are called sodbusters, the farmers, and that they sacrificed tremendously in order to get across our country through a notion called manifest destiny. In effect, there's different interpretations, but the interpretation I like to use is manifesting destiny means you were guided by God to conquer all obstacles in your way. If a person was an obstacle, a tribe was an obstacle, you conquered them. And you had the moral equivalency to do so because you were not considering these people human. They certainly were not human in the way that society had given people rights. They were not as human as women, who still weren't given the same rights to vote or power. They certainly weren't as human as Native Americans. They got the last group to actually get the right to vote, nor African Americans. So a whole lot of people were never considered anything more than someone else's property or someone else's annoyance to be handled, displaced, or removed. So that's the danger of that mindset. And one of the leading philosophical pragmatists, a person who had a very sharp mind, was capable of some of the deepest intellectual thoughts, but also was capable of some of the deepest character and moral flaws of any person in power in American history, and that was Thomas Jefferson. But Jefferson was unique because in one simple signature, he was able to double the size of the continental United States, and that was because of what was known as the Louisiana Purchase back in 1803. So here we had a president who knew that we needed resources. And one of the things you'll notice in all of our efforts, including Vietnam, was that the people really behind Rostow and some of the other economists behind the Vietnam incursion, which the French had been there before, so it lasted over 20 years between the French and the Americans, was that you cannot cooperate, communicate with people who are, in effect, illiterate on economics. And yet they all saw that the most valuable reason to be in Vietnam was it had a population that was capable of extracting resources at an inexpense to the corporate masters, the imperialists, exploiting that, and then bringing that to the main markets in Europe and the United States, and developing and emerging markets in India and Brazil, other countries, even South Korea. And therefore, they felt that communism and the inherent rigidity of communist doctrine would not allow them to know what to do. They were not capable of engaging in anything capitalist. So, since you couldn't challenge them, you had to kill them, you had to destroy them. So that was manifest destiny in, you know, a more current manifestation. But it was still getting after the resources. The people there were immaterial. They didn't count. How many? Well, 3.4 million died in Vietnam. Another million died in Laos and Cambodia in secret bombings. So you're talking about almost 5 million people minimally died. Now, do you have a single American history anywhere in our standard textbooks that describes the genocide that we inflicted upon a people who were agrarian, very backwards? They had no air force, they had no navy, they had no satellites, they had no submarines, they had no, you know, they had no ships. They just had people with old World War II rifles on camels and horses and snaking them through the jungle to fight the most advanced, sophisticated, well-armed army in the world. And they won. And they didn't win because we didn't have the will to fight. We sacrificed 58,000 dead Americans and over a half million who were injured and 3 million suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and or exposure to the deadly Agent Orange. In fact, I helped Paul Rudishin, and he's really the hero there because he spent years coming on my radio show and to talk about the dangers of Agent Orange and why the veterans who fought should be first acknowledged that many of them were suffering from diseases of Agent Orange made by Monsanto and then compensated. In the end, Congress actually blinked and gave them $2 billion in compensation. Now, mind you, divide 3.5 million into 2 billion, and it's nothing to the individual who are still many still suffering to this day. But you can only do that. You can only do that as a nation, as a body politic, if you had no value, no redeeming value in the people you were killing. And that is exactly how the entire West was conquered and settled. Now, we got an area that we went from the Mississippi River to the Rocky Mountains. Now, I've been to the Rocky Mountains many times. I've gone across the Great Plains. I've driven across the Great Plains. I wanted to talk with the farmers, the ranchers, especially recently about what's happened to their water, why are there all these dead carcasses everywhere. And at that time, no one had gone across. In fact, we didn't even know what was out there. So Thomas Jefferson said, well, let's have an expedition. And he got two people to head the expedition, Lieutenant William Clark and Captain Meriwether Lewis. And they did an expedition that lasted from 1804 to 1806. And they were out there mainly to make maps. After all, how could you explore something if you didn't take maps? And how would you know where we could gain some economic benefit if you didn't know how to get there? They also envisioned at the beginning of this whole trek that there might be some way to take the Missouri River up and then find another way to get to the Columbia River and get into Oregon. Now, we really didn't want to get into Oregon at that time because we didn't control Oregon. In fact, that was controlled by Great Britain as well as Canada. And that concerned us because there had been someone who made that entire journey. He was the first person, in fact, to go across the Canada and into Oregon. And that was in 1793, Alexander Mackenzie. That was a remarkable journey he took by any standards because he didn't have a whole expedition. He didn't have funding. He was simply an animal trader, meaning he got pelts, mainly at that time, pelts from beaver. And but that let Jefferson and others know, okay, we don't want this being a battle with Great Britain because they might come down and send expeditions and start to go into territory. That territory, by the way, is rather huge. It is somewhere between 800,000 square miles and about 820. We don't know exactly, but that's close enough. So you're talking about a huge area that no Caucasian had ever gone through all that. And the reason that Jefferson was able to negotiate the Louisiana Purchase is because the French foreign minister, Charles Maurice de Talleyrand, wanted to get rid of the very important port that the French controlled in New Orleans. But that didn't go anywhere. So then the French made a phenomenal offer, one that by any standard today was probably one of the greatest property transfers in history. For $15 million, that's it, $15 million, Congress approved and we bought the Louisiana Purchase. Now, imagine having everything from Iowa and Missouri and Nebraska and Arkansas and Kansas and Oklahoma and Louisiana, all that territory. So it made a big, big deal. Now, so then they took Lewis and Clark out there, and they're mapping everything. And by the way, their mapping was darn good. And they did it through what was called the Core of Discovery. And they traveled, and not easy to travel. Remember, they had to go against the current. They were going upstream over 1,000 miles. They traveled in boats, and they paddled. And needless to say, you're going to be exhausted. It would take an extremely hardy person to paddle upstream against a current. Also, part of that was in hot weather. Have you ever been on the Missouri or the Mississippi or any of these rivers in the summertime? Even today, you're inundated by mosquitoes. And they didn't have the mosquito netting. They didn't have fans. They had no way of protecting themselves. So people, a lot of people would get sick. Some died. They finally got to a place where winter was coming on, and they were running low on provisions. They hadn't anticipated because no one had done it before. They didn't know what they should take and how much they should take. So they found a village, a village by the Indians. There were actually two Indian tribes there, Mandan and the Hidatsa. And that was way up where now it would be in North Dakota. So you're talking about being almost up to Canada. Now there they tried to get themselves together for the spring when they take off again. And now imagine you have hundreds of Indian tribes. They only met one that was hostile out of hundreds. And yet the myth of history was savages everywhere. It was not true. Not true. However, each one of the tribes controlled different territory. And they would have it marked out by certain types of landmarks. For example, if you were in Colorado and there's a certain peak, it's 14,000 feet. I've been at that peak. In fact, I've sat on that peak to take photographs of how beautiful nature was. And they would say, from that peak over to that lake, and from that lake over to that valley, and from that valley where that big boulder is, and that was your territory. It might be 20 miles, it might be 200 miles. And how they were able to survive, and this is what you should know, there should be monuments today to two people. Toussaint, an Indian warrior, Carbonneau, and his wife, who you may have heard of, Sacagawea. They were Shoshone, and they led the party. Without them, Lewis and Clark would have died because they did not know how to prepare. They did not know that if you ate animal meat all the time, you can have a special type of protein dysentery. They did not know that all around them were green leaves from trees, especially pine trees, that if they boiled the leaves, that gave them ascorbic acid and helps prevent dysentery. They didn't know this. They didn't know of all the roots that you could eat that would provide you with protein and nourishment. They didn't know about echinacea. And yet the natives, every one of these natives, had people in the tribe who understood how to live off the land. Now, think of this. Pull back for a moment. All across the Pacific Northwest, going clear across and then into the continental United States, you had tribes living for hundreds of years in the same place. And all they had were teepees and some lodges. How in the world does a group of people survive 12 months a year, stay in vital health in such inclement conditions? Well, simple. They learned the art of passing down stories, verbal stories through language. For example, where you're on a lake, that lake, you can put logs in a section of the lake, and when the ice comes, the logs are b***ing the ice, so you still have water you can fish from. And when they fished, they just didn't fish for a day or what they needed. They might catch thousands of fish, de-entrail them. Then if they had access to salt, and some tribes did, some didn't, they could trade it. Then you salted it, and otherwise you put it over hickory, and you smoked it until it was as dry as jerky. And then you kept it into a dry house. or let's say you get a venison, let's say a 200-pound deer. You skin it, you use the skin, you dry the skin, and then you apply natural oils that they would have, and that made it soft, and you made your clothes from that. And they would have blankets. They would even have teepees lined on the inside of buffalo skins. So they had super insulated materials. They also knew that they boiled their water, because you could end up with what's called beaver fever. Even if today people go in the woods, they think, oh, there's a stream. Unless you're getting the water directly from the string source, everything else after that can be polluted with parasites, and generally are. Why do you think a tiger, a lion, a lioness, in the wild generally lives anywhere from 8 to 12 years? In captivity, 20 to 30 years. Clean water. After all, you're going over to a water hole. The animals have gone in there, like the elephants have gone in, the hippopotamus, that you don't want to mess with. More people are killed in Africa by hippopotamus by poisonous snakes. I mean, nothing goes near a hippopotamus. In fact, crocodiles fear hippopotamus because one snap and they can break a crocodile in half. They are very territorial and they can be very aggressive. But and most people don't think, gee whiz, you know, how can all these animals be using the same water hole and it's filthy and survive? Well, they do because their body adapts. They have a different microbiome in their body and they can digest toxins. They have much higher capacity to deal with acidity. And yet, you give them clean water, so their livers are not poisoned, their kidneys are not poisoned, they can live a long life. Same with a human being. So anyhow, so people learned to survive by what they grew in season. They also knew that if they grew any kind of tuber, the tuber can stay in the ground all winter, be harvested. We think about, oh, there it is, it's done, harvest it. No, not true. So here you had the taking on this trip. And again, if you want to give someone recognition for Lewis and Clark's expedition, the mapping, yes, they get the credit for. But the peaceful coexistence was clearly Sacagawea, and given no credit today. In any case, they made the trip and they had to get through the treacherous mountain ranges of the Rockies. And if you've been down the Rockies, you can go for days and never see a way of getting across. It was the biggest impediment. You either had to go very south, in which case you went into desert, and many, many people died in the desert, or you had to go very north, in which case then you better get there before winter, because a lot of people didn't. Thousands and thousands died because there was no way back, there were no provisions, and you were exhausted. You probably end up eating the oxen or the animals, because people took lard, coffee, sugar with them, maybe jerky, and almost nothing else. Had they taken large amounts of dried food, beans, legumes, grains, then they could have made their supplies. Took over 1,000 pounds per Conestoga wagon, what were called prairie schooners, because they kind of looked at a distance like a schooner ship. In any case, all told, the second group after them traveled 8,000 miles, and they identified all kinds of unique and rare animals, but they also encountered 50 Native American tribes, all except one, the Blackfeet, were thoughtful and kind. So understand this bridging. You take a tribe that is friendly with all the tribes around it, and it knows the way to get to the next place, and the people from your tribe, Sacagawea, she is interpreting on behalf of the next tribe, and there was always ways of communicating tribe to tribe. And because there was a lot of breeding between the people, having children, learning both languages, both tongues. So they hopscotch clear across America, being guided by the tribes who shared the language and information from the previous tribe. And that part of history is not told. You might have heard of one person, Daniel Boone. Now, he was a unique person. It was through Daniel Boone, who lived in North Carolina, who was courageous, and he did this really on his own. There are a couple who did it on there. John Coulter did it on his own. Those were the two main, what you call rugged mountain men. But their mountains were tiny compared to the mountains where they'd never been. And back in 1775, mind you, 1775, before we signed the Declaration of Independence, he had crossed the Appalachians. Now, today you can drive the route he took. You can drive from West Virginia is a very small state, and you can drive from Northern Virginia, Northwest Virginia. Remember, Virginia and West Virginia used to be the same state until one seceded, which was West Virginia. You can drive from Northwest Virginia, Virginia into West Virginia, down at the bottom, Beckley, then go across. You can go into Tennessee, up through Kentucky, even up into Ohio, all in one day. So what took him months, because he was doing it on foot, you can do in one day. But he was the first person to really do that. And that was a big deal. Now later, John Coulter in 1807, he went much further. He crossed the Mississippi River and even went up to Montana and Wyoming. And you wouldn't know that you're not in Wyoming when you're in Montana because outside the Grand Tetons, and if you've never been to the Grand Tetons, it's one of the most beautiful natural mountains. It's not big. You can climb around them in one day. And it's in Wyoming, but right up near Montana. But out there you have the Big Plains. Now, the Big Plains means that nobody wanted to stay there. Everybody going to the West Coast was going because of gold being discovered out there, and gold out west, and then silver in Colorado. In fact, silver became famous because of its mining of all the silver. And so there were multiple different expeditions. And one of them that is well known is John Charles Fremont. And he was one of those people nicknamed the Pathfinder, because they would go on really long trips. Then they would write about it. And I'm guessing a lot of what they were writing was lies. And these dime novels back then, if you've never been west, if you've never seen a Native American, if you've never seen the springs, hot springs coming up as in Yellowstone, then it's all fascinating to you. Be like us wanting to know what's on the moon. Well, someone got there and told us what's on the moon. So everyone's fascinated about it. So here we have first the explorers, and then behind the explorers came the opportunists, the trappers. Now, there's this legend about these trappers, all individuals, and they're out there rugged, living for months on end, alone. These were called the mountain men, like Jedediah Smith and Joe Walker. And if you've ever been over to New Mexico, then it's Kit Carson's. And these people were famous. They were in all these, you know, serialized novels about the great mountain men. Well, the mountain men weren't so great, and the trappers were anything but great. But here's how it worked. Trappers rarely were alone, because alone you had very little chance of surviving, because you were trapping at the northern end of where the animals survived, mainly in the lakes and the rivers where the beaver were. They did hunt other things, but the beaver was what the fur companies wanted. So you might work 20, 30, 100 people in the same area, and you all work for the same person. Your guns, your food, your clothing, your traps were all paid for by a animal broker. In return, you brought down from the mountains, you brought down to what looked like a little fort. And this is where all the skinning occurred, and this is where the curing of the pelts, and then those would be transferred from there to the cities where they would be manufactured into garments. But these people would make a lot of money. Some could make $3,000 a year. Now, you think, well, that's not a whole lot. when the average person was making $1.50 a day, and you're making $3,000, they're making $500 working every day, and you're making $3,000, and you're taking 2 months off. And here's why almost all of them ended up broke. Because the only place they really could go is back to the settlement, and the settlement is where you had all these brokers, and you would give them the pelts, and then based upon the quality of the pelts and how many pelts you gave them, you know, a good haul would be 400, a great haul would be 500 pelts. And then you would get paid, and you had no place to go. And here were saloons and prostitutes, and that's where, and gambling, and that's where you spent your money. So most of them who had a lot of money would be broke by the time they had to go back out in the fall. And they had to be refitted and new food, and they would have lodges where their food would be stored and other provisions. So that's why this, they went out there. And then that all ended in the 1840s because they had killed off so many animals. There were really very few animals left, and it was no longer profit. Also, the whole style changed. And you had people doing Southwest tours, and you had people doing Midwest and others doing North. So, and then you have someone I know everyone in this audience would have heard of, John James Audubon. He was one of the most celebrated painters and sketchers and naturalists, and he went out in the 1820s, and he was very poor. He lived off the land. But today, his sketches of the flora and fauna, the animals, the birds, are some of the most beautiful and accurate that we've ever seen. There were others, George Catlin. He spent the 1830s out there, and he visited over 70 Native American tribes, or over 500, by the way, and he appreciated them. And he was one of the very first Americans, George Catlin, C-A-T-L-I-N, who brought back a completely different story of what it was to be one of these Native Americans and visit them and their traditions, their culture, their gentleness, their giving. He showed them what they really are at their best. Almost everyone else portrayed them as savages. Do you see a monument to him? Have you heard about him? Probably not. Then the next thing, after the initial explorers, the pathfinders, and the hunters, then came the farmers. And they started stopping way before other places. And thousands upon tens of thousands in the 1840s went out there. In fact, you would have immigrants, people from Ireland and Scotland and Scandinavian countries and Italy and England. And these were people who were poor in their country, saw that there was no advantage, no improvement in quality of life, so they wanted to go to America. Because by this time, there was all this about land so fertile, and of course everybody was overstating the benefits. So they got there, and some of them didn't have covered wagons. Some of them actually had pole carts, meaning you literally put your possessions in a series of carts, and you, much like a rickshaw, and you in front, or the strongest man, would pull them. Now imagine doing that trek when there were no roads. And then so when you came to some soil and some water, you stopped. The trouble is they frequently stopped in the Great Plains. And who in the world would have wanted to make a home in the Great Plains? You had droughts. You had wind. If you've ever gotten out of a car and you just stand there in the Great Plains of Wyoming or Montana, the wind hits you and you think, whoa. Well, there were no trees. The only homes you could ever build were sod homes, generally 2 feet thick of sod. And they were certainly insulated, but it was extremely desolate. There was nothing for miles, for hundreds of miles. So you had to take everything with you needed, and you better stay in a community because it was very easy on your own to die. Now, others were more intrepid, and they would get the pay for the stagecoaches, not stagecoaches, but the covered wagons, the schooners, to take him out further out into California. And the people who profited were not the gold miners, because that was discovered and they had this, you know, long trek. And but rather it was the people who set up the businesses around them. And that meant that if you had a town, the person that had the general store, the restaurant, the hotel, the laundry and barbershop, the brothels. In some towns, especially in California, you had more brothels than any other building. In fact, sometimes more than all the other buildings, because people were frustrated. They wanted to release themselves sexually, and even though sexually transmitted disease was rampant, they didn't care, and especially the prospectors. So here we had the big movement to the Midwest and the big movement to the far West. And then the people who lasted, the people who stayed, were the people who didn't go to prospect and didn't go to set up a farm. And yet the first people that really made it big were the cattle. A group of people got together and did the cattle ranching together, because they would supply anywhere from 7 to 11 million pounds of meat. And that was on a slow time. So their big journey was, and this was facilitated by the train that took people over there much easier, without all the dangers of dying in inclement weather and being robbed by, you know, by bandits. They would just go on a train and go back and forth and stop at different towns to see if they liked them. But you had the cattle barons, and they had the largest amount of land, and the next largest land owners were the railroad companies, and they were selling land very cheap. And then we had the federal law, which allowed every pioneer to take a square mile, that's 640 acres, if you put up signs saying it's your land, and if you entered into an agreement and signed an official purchase, and then you built a home within 6 months. So we had, these were called sodbusters, and tens of thousands went out there because they had free land, and they built their homes. And so between the railroads, which cut right through all Indian property, they killed the Indians, used hundreds of thousands of labor from Chinese mainly, and when they die, they just throw them into a ditch. They didn't care. So when you ride a railroad, understand who built it: slave labor. When you made fortunes, understand how you made it: slave labor. And then those who heard about Sutter's Mill in Central California in 1848, and everybody's head exploded. They thought they could go out there and get rich, and it didn't happen. Most of them ended up dirt poor, but they were known as 49ers. Why? Because 1849 is when the big gold discoveries happened. And between 1847 and 1849, you had San Francisco from a little town of under 400 to 500 miners to 25,000 people. And with that came all the supporting industries. And then Jackson, Colorado, and Denver followed up. And so you had enormous populations. In fact, Denver, Colorado was nothing back in 1869. But then in a few years, it had milled over $82 million in silver over about a quarter century, and it became a major metropolis. But remember, all that was based upon first taking the land, killing the buffalo, killing the subsistence animals the natives used, demonized the natives, giving no support to African Americans, including those that fought in the 200,000 African Americans who fought in the Civil War for the Union, giving nothing to women. And those who managed to build a life out there, they struggled. They were hardy, absolutely. But rather than doing what some commentators on Fox do, which is they're instead of looking at the West development as a conjugation of different cultures mixing and being suppressed or dominant through manifest destiny, they have misconstrued or left out this part of it. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.